Welcome to Zen Mind, a podcast featuring talks from Zenki Dilo Roshi, the guiding teacher at the Boulder Zen Center in Boulder, Colorado. If you are enjoying these talks and you would like to dive deeper into the topics discussed by Zenki Roshi in this podcast, consider becoming a premium subscriber. This will give you access to recorded Q&A sessions related to each talk, as well as previously unreleased talks from our intensives. Becoming a premium subscriber helps to support the continuation of the podcast and Zenki Roshi's teachings. Learn more about it by clicking the link in the show notes. As always, you're welcome to join us live for these Dharma talks. You can join us online via Zoom or in person. You can find a link to our website with the Dharma talk schedule and more information also in the show notes. Now here's Zenki Roshi.
Good morning. A little while ago, my twin sister FaceTimed me, and she said, "Oh, you look very tired." And I said, "Oh, this is probably true." And I said, "It's because of that rat." You know, my family and I live upstairs in this like little weird apartment because it's basically not an apartment. It's like three hotel rooms. So we have three little rooms and three bathrooms. And one of the bathrooms is a closet. Now it's like it has some clothes and has the litter box for the cat. And it also had the cat food. And there was a rat that chewed itself through the wall and came and ate the cat food. And we could hear it munching on the cat food while we were in the bedroom. And I was like, the rat every night comes, eats the cat food, and then goes back into the wall. So something needed to be done. So I tried to trap the rat. It's too smart. It doesn't want to be trapped. So yesterday, Ralph, who's helping with handyman jobs around here, he came and I said, "Just, if you would, cover the hole, you know, new drywall, let's keep the rat out." All night, the rat chewed through the fresh drywall, made another hole. I couldn't sleep. It was like eating drywall. So I didn't sleep. But I thought, you know, this is a disturbance. And this is the problem of life. We're just disturbed and we're trying to do something about it. But if you don't want to hate rats, you know, it's good. I mean, you can work with it in different ways, but sometimes I think, aren't rodents the mammals that survived when the dinosaurs, you know, lost reign of the earth? And it's because of the rats that we exist, you know. So, okay, thank you, rat, for giving us our life. And so you can have some cat food. So let's see if I can say something else than reflecting on the rat. There's someone I work with who recently spoke to me about losing a health crisis and how much it rattled him. And it touched my heart. It's like, you know, without going into details, and I want to be confidential and everything, it's a serious loss of sensory capacity. But it doesn't really matter. It could be like you have an accident and your body is damaged. You lose cognitive agility and function, or Or you lose a loved one, or you experience the crisis of going through a divorce or a significant relationship, like with a teacher or a parent, or your business collapses, you know, or you lose your professional position or your social standing or, you know, anything like that. What's the common denominator in this, in these kinds of experiences? You know, what is the, why are we shaken to the core by events like this? Now, I can bring immediately, I mean, I think you know the territory, right? Like, whether you have experienced such a crisis in a profound way or not, you do know the territory. You will have a felt sense about it. As I'm speaking, I'm assuming that that's the case. If you are a sensitive person, you can attune yourself to this kind of crisis. Now I can bring words to it right away now, you know, to make it clear what we're dealing with. So I'm asking, you know, what's the common denominator in these kinds of crisis events? Maybe imagine that it all happens all at once. All of it. Loss of health and bodily integrity and mental acuity and relationship and social position, and anyway, I don't have to repeat it all. And you're aging, and you know, it's like you start to feel death in the wings of the theater of life. By the way, this is happening to people, you know, all of this all at once. This is happening in Ukraine. This is happening in Gaza. This happened to people who were attacked by Hamas in Israel. So I can bring language, you know, and we have Buddhist teachings, and we can bring language to this situation, and we can say, like, oh, what we are confronting, what we're facing is impermanence. What we're fearing in this kind of crisis is the groundlessness of life, that there's no, like, fixed reality that we can stand on. It's like this carpet that's pulled, the rug that's pulled from under our feet is this, like that, right? So now I bring this kind of language, and then you say, oh yeah, you know, check, I understand. This, you know, this can't happen when you study Buddhism. If you really want to study Buddhism, you can't make this, like, bring this language and then make the check mark and say, I understand. You know, it's funny. It's because when you create this understanding, which is fine on some level, you are creating another ground to stand on, another illusory ground to stand on. It's your understanding. So it's necessary to remain in the expert in this, you know, I'm bringing a lot of language here, but in this non-conceptual experiential disturbance, to feel the impermanence, to feel the groundlessness. Not to know about it. So in that sense, if you can take it well, this kind of crisis, this health crisis, this divorce, this separation from a loved one or a significant relationship, that has grounded us, and the groundlessness that shines through, you know, in the crisis, if you can take it well, you can bow to it and say, like, here's, you know, I'm getting a glimpse of how things actually exist, and also a glimpse of how things don't exist. They don't exist with stability. Then you are in the experiential territory of Buddhism. Now it's there's this kind of disturbance, this shakenness, this lack of ground. So what do we do with it? Now, the typical response, reaction to this is to defend against it. I don't know, I'll venture to say most people are not able, and many people are not willing to tolerate this disturbance, this groundlessness. So for all there our lives, we may be engaged in various defense strategies against this disturbance, against this groundlessness. And now you can bring language again and say, like, well, how does it look? Like, how does this defense strategy look? And then you can say, like with a Buddhist language, the way this defense strategy takes form is as a self. The perception of a self, the construction of an identity, the narrative of who you are is a defense strategy against this groundlessness. So if you're just a worldly person, you know, you can look at yourself, you can look at other people and say, like, you know, you can use various aspects of your existence to try to create some ground. The way you think of yourself, of who you are, what you contribute in the world, the way you think you have some say in how other people think of you, and how you are trying to stabilize relationships so that they don't just fall apart, or how you have, you know, acquire property that gives you security, and how you hold on to it, because without it, you feel the groundlessness. How you, you know, hold on to a certain purpose in life so that your life has meaning, and that other people can see it as meaningful, so that you have a certain social standing. This is all the self. You know, if we have a sense of, if you have a sense of impermanence, if you conduct yourself as a functional self, you know, like you have a certain role in a context and you perform that role and you serve other people and you serve yourself too, you know, you make some money and you, but you're not constructing this function, this self as function, if you don't construct it as an identity, you're fine. It's necessary. It's okay. And it's also not the self that Buddhism criticizes. It's not. What the self that is revealed as an illusion is a self that we perceive as giving us a sense of permanence or of ultimate reliance. It's just function, it's just role. Yeah, it's necessary, part of our daily existence. You know, like you have a role in an organization and then the organization goes bankrupt and then you have a role in a different organization. Or, you know, like you are a father and then your child, you know, is grown up and then you are not the same kind of father anymore. And then that father role disappears or changes, becomes a different role, or your child dies. That's impermanence. Or any role, right? If you are religiously inclined, you know, we could look at religion as another way to create groundedness, to create ground. It's like then instead of, you know, you see that you can't rely on the self in these various aspects that I've just pointed to. So then you want to rely on a different kind of self, on a true self, on a transcendental self, on some kind of self that is more than this small self. So you have a true self, and somehow this true self is removed from the impermanent worldly affairs. It's like a, it survives death. You know, it's like an, it's like a soul, or it's a universal self that covers the entire world. Is not, is almost like God, or, oh yeah, God. I mean, that should be, that should provide a ground. If you can't rely on the impermanent forms of the world, including this body and mind, then there must be something else to rely on. So let's call that God. How sure are you about all this stuff? I've told this story before. It reminds me of my great aunt who was dying, and I had the chance to visit her before she died. A while before she died, but it was clear it was, she was old, in her 90s. And I had just started to practice Buddhism, and she was a Christian, and she was not exactly a nun, but she was kind of an ordained nurse. And in her old age, and she was celibate, and in her old age, the whatever Christian institution she was affiliated with, they had to take her in. So she had a room in this like nursery home that was run by other nuns. There she was in her little room, and I visited her, and she asked me what I was doing, and I said, I'm practicing Buddhism, and she was very interested, and she said, like, explain it to me. And so
I explained what I understood. I was just a kid, it feels like, a long time ago. And she said, oh, this is all very interesting. It sounds true, you know. And then she says, I'm sorry. I can't change now. Okay, good. But it was clear she, everything she believed her whole life was starting to crumble. She didn't believe it that firmly anymore. She's like, she came around to what in Zen we would call not knowing. She's like, oh, I don't know. I don't know what's going on, but I'm dying. There's another kind of like subtle ways that we want to create ground. It's an everyday activity. It's language. I pointed to it already, you know, you bring some language, you say emptiness, non-self, and then you have a ground because now you can have this sense of understanding something. But every word, I mean, if we don't think about language very much, I love language. I have thought about it a lot. I think about it a lot. But not everyone does. And I think the common way you feel language is like you say something and you think that the word that you're using points to something that exists. Like a thing, a referent, as you know, a linguist would say, there's something out there that you name. Like, here's this stick and here's this microphone. And I have this like 3-year-old son now, and you know, that's exactly how we teach the world to him. It's like he says, what is it? You say, like, oh, it's that. It's this, it's that, yeah. All these things. So language, in its capacity to conceptualize and use names, suggests that the world is a constellation of things. Yeah, you agree? It's like, most common worldview is worldview, like what is the world? Most people would say, well, it's a constellation of things, and then these things are in relationship with each other, and that's the world. All the things and all the relationships between the things, that's the world. But Buddhism teaches us that that's wrong. It's a wrong view. It's false. Language creates that illusion. It's a very convincing illusion. So what's an alternative worldview that is maybe more, I wouldn't even say true, you know, because what do we know? But it's, you know, from a Buddhist point of view, you would say it's more practical in the sense of reducing suffering. That's what we're after. We want to suffer less from the disturbance of groundlessness. We'll be less defended, more vulnerable, more true to how we actually exist. By the way, as an aside, I don't know why this is, but you know, I assume the reason you're here is because you find in yourself the need to be true. I don't mean this in terms of like the truth. I mean just like true, like the way a line is true or something, like to be straightforward, to not make, you know, to not be defended, to not make excuses about yourself, to not distort your existence somehow. This is just like, inmost request, I think we could say with Suzuki Roshi's phrase, it's like this inmost request to have a straightforward, true life. So that's why, you know, at some point when you wake up sufficiently, it's like illusion doesn't suffice. It's like you can't just keep making shit up. I mean, you can, but it's not satisfying. This is the problem. It's not satisfying. All right. So in that sense, a different worldview would be to view the world not as a constellation of things, but as a as activity, as in maybe more accurately, interactivity. Now, Thich Nhat Hanh speaks of interbeing, and you know, this term has influenced a lot of people. And it's that territory, right? Interbeing. Because I'm obsessed with language, I'm like, I don't know, being. What does the word being bring? Brings permanence. Interbecoming sounds a bit weird. Interaction, interactivity is better, I think. Sorry. Who am I to criticize? I'm not criticizing Thich Nhat Hanh. I'm just taking what he brings and feeling it out on my own, which is what we need to do. You can use interbeing, it's fine. Interactivity. I read this phrase, it blew my mind. Two things have one interaction. Oh, you want to understand interdependence? There it is. Two things have one interaction. I was always like, when people say everything is relationship, and it's like, it doesn't do it. Because to have a relationship, you have to have two things. If you don't have two things, you don't have a relationship. But you can have an interaction. It's kind of the same thing, but it does bring something else. And the interaction changes the things all the time. They're not staying the same as the interaction occurs. So if you want to think about oneness, you know, if you think about oneness in terms of being, you're trying to make a ground. But if you think about oneness as interaction, you're not making a ground. You're making a constant change. You understand the field of being as ongoing change, as continual birth and death, continuous birth and death, coming and going. But it's one interaction. There's your oneness, but not as being, not as God, not as some metaphysical entity, not as something you can merge with. You're already part of it. There's no need for merging. See? Already part of the interaction. Already held by the field of interactivity. Just not with some kind of permanence. This person who talked to me about the crisis, noticed in the crisis how he was trying to instrumentalize practice. This was another disturbance. It's like, oh, now that I'm experiencing this crisis, I want to use practice to get to some ground. It shows up in so many ways. You know, you practice because you want your mind to be calm. You practice because you want to overcome this habit and become this better person so that you can respect yourself more, that other people respect you or some whatever. There it is, the self. Instrumentalizing practice for itself. to make a ground. This was so touching, so honest, right? To say, oh, and now I'm seeing how I'm trying to use practice to do this thing. So I found myself saying, practice is not about perfection. Or perfecting. It's about openness. Zazen is about, well, look, here you could say, it's not openness. There you have a thing again, as if openness was something that is achievable. Zazen is about continuous opening. You sit and you find your body and mind and the world in appearing moment after moment as the succession of, so you'd say in Buddhism, you'd say as a succession of dharmas, as a succession of units of experience, you know, this is happening in the body, then attention shifts, this is happening in the mind, this is happening in the world, like as if these realms could be separated, but here we are using words. It's kind of like a pulse of appearance. And this is our life as we bring attention to it. And not all of these appearances are great. Some are quite painful and disturbing and so forth, you know. And then your practice is continual opening to the dharmas as they are, as they appear. In this opening to what is, there's the isness again, right? It's not being, it's activity, ising. Opening up to the ising, you make a potentially, many of you have, you make a surprising discovery. It's like there's a spaciousness, an openness, a mind field that is able to host whatever appears. It's not something I have to do. It's something that's already happening. This is already my life process. It's not manufactured. So as I'm loosening the contraction, you know, contracting away from the thing I don't want to experience or contracting into the thing that I want to hold on to, I feel this openness that is able and willing to let these appearances come and go, thoughts, sensations, perceptions, the stuff of our aliveness. Chögyam Trungpa has quoted, and you've heard this before, many of you, that awakening is like jumping out of an airplane. The bad news is there's no parachute. The good news is there's no ground. This is good. But again, you know, somebody says something smart, you're like, oh yeah, huh? I understand. But if you want to turn it into practice, you know, feel how much desire you have for a parachute as you're falling. How how much energy you expend into making the parachute as you're falling. It's not there, but, you know, let's make one. The self. The defense against groundlessness. It's impossible to fall without a parachute. It's like you're going to hit the ground. It's like it's the most vulnerable situation you can imagine. So some realization is necessary that there is indeed no ground, because then the groundlessness turns into, you know, I hesitate to say it, but some kind of safety. No danger. Fearlessness, as the Heart Sutra would say. It turns into fearlessness. It's like, oh, I'm falling. All right, fine. No ground. I'm falling. You could start to, like, play around. You could play around with falling. So what are we taking refuge in? Like, what are we doing with this disturbance of groundlessness? Now, is there refuge? Like, in this image, it's like you take refuge in falling and playfulness. The language that needs to come here is, it's like you have to listen from your experience, or else it can all be interpreted in the wrong way. You understand? It's like if you take emptiness and interpret it the wrong way, Nagarjuna said that, it's the most dangerous kind. It's like a snake not picked up the right way. It's like you can interpret emptiness and say, like, oh, anything goes, nothing matters, you know, or I'm falling, I'm playing around, anything, you know, there are no ethics, everything is a construct, you know, who cares about other people? You can do that. You're just making another ground, pretending it's groundlessness, but giving yourself license to behave aggressively or with ignorance. It's not that way. Let me do one round and then it's enough. You know, the way we open up, let's say in Zazen, doesn't have to be Zazen, it's just in all circumstances of your life, actually. But we do need a place to practice this opening, continuous opening, in a dedicated way. Well, let me be a little philosophical here. It's experiential, but it sounds maybe philosophical. I speak about felt sense, you know, regularly. And I recently got, somebody emailed me and says, like, I don't understand what you mean, this is felt sense. I don't get it. Okay. Let me try to put it a certain way that it sounds maybe complicated. The body, our body sensations, because we are one interaction, right? Because we are one interaction with everything, with the 10,000 things, because we are one interaction and not a separate thing, the body implies the entire world. And how do you know how the body implies the entire world? That is the felt sense. You could put a different word there. It is the implicit. It is that which is not explicit yet. It is that which is not explicated, expressed, turned into an action, a word, a relationship. So our body minds actually hold the complexity of the world. It's completely intimate. It's not out there. It's right here. So moment after moment, as you are intimate with, open to, you, if you are disturbed by the complexity of the world that you carry as, like, in my own mind, I call it an implexity. Because it's intimate, and it is, you know, what we usually think of the inside. The complexity of the world is actually an implexity. It's folded into us. That's what implex means, you know. Plex means fold. Folded into us. Each person has the world folded into themselves. And as you are open to, sensitive with this implexity, there are steps that you can take moment after moment. What I call, some of you heard this, carrying the present into the present. Carrying the present forward into the present. We don't know about the future, but we know about the next moment. The next moment is implied in this moment. If you attend, the next step comes from how it is implied. If you're rock climbing, the next step is implied. You can't think to the top of the cliff, but you can think to the next hold. Think, feel, think, feel to the next hold. Know what the body can do as the next step. This is all we can do, really. But in that taking of the next step, in this carrying the present forward into the present, because this next moment becomes the present, it's not arbitrary. It's not arbitrary. You cannot just make shit up. No. There's a kind of, you need to respect how you imply the world. So people want to construct identities. When you say, you know, who am I? There's two aspects to it. There's the openness. It's like the field of awareness in which everything happens. And then there is this implexity that instructs us into the next step. This is where ethics reside. This is where you can live a true life that is true to you. It's not like, oh, I want to fantasize to be this person in the world. You don't have that choice. You just have this body in mind, and you have this body in mind to live. And if it's a small life compared to some other person who has, like, seemingly a big life, then, you know, make a good small life. Until your life opens up big, or it never does. I don't care. It doesn't matter. It's like you can live this next step with integrity. And if it's the process of aging, you live that process of aging with integrity. And if it's the process of losing your sight or your hearing, you live that with integrity. And if you are in the middle of a divorce, you live that with integrity. There might be a rightness in the divorce. You have to discover that rightness. Like, what is the complexity of this situation? So what I call implexity is the way we imply, or the way the body-mind implies, the complexity of a situation. And it knows, not in a conceptual way, it knows how to take the next step. So there's the side of openness, just being relaxed, be at ease with the complications of life. Can't be avoided. There are rats. We don't like them, but they, you know, oh well, I didn't like it last night, but it belongs nonetheless. And then there is this making use of this openness to be attuned to how the complexity of the world is implied in this form, this form. I'm speaking implicitly, I'm speaking about form and emptiness. How it is implied. You know, we say emptiness is form. Yeah, but in this way. Okay, good luck. Thank you.